Right, our next speaker is Denise Jarea, who we're very fortunate to have recruited here from Duke as a professor of pharmacology, Department of Pharmacology here at UC San Diego. So thanks, Denise, for being here.
Thanks very much for including me in your meeting this year, and I'm really looking forward to being part of this community. It's, I think, really special in a lot of ways, so I'm excited about being here in a couple of weeks. And what I thought I'd talk about quickly is our work over the last few years looking at connections between stem cells and cancer, and especially how classic developmental pathways and programs may be dysregulated in oncogenesis and how they may be targets for therapy, especially in context of leukemia. So we've looked at development programs like Katrina mentioned, and she's also done obviously a lot of good work on this, such as Wnt, Hedgehog, and Notch pathways. And more recently, we've taken some of this work and looked really at the question of cancer progression and how leukemias become more aggressive. So this shows you the models we've used. So we're starting here with chronic leukemia, so chronic myelogenous leukemia, which is a more slow-growing disease with maturation intact and is more manageable, and is driven mostly by BCR-ABL, and many of you are familiar with this, and a lot of work from Katrina's lab. And this disease can progress into a more aggressive phase called blast crisis CML, which bears a lot of resemblance with de novo acute myeloid leukemias as well, which are very therapy resistant and have a very poor prognosis. And at a cellular level, the real sort of distinctive characteristic of this cancer is that they're aggressive and their maturation is blocked, so they're very immature looking. In our case, we model this using a translocation called MUV98 HOXA9, which is associated with both BCCML as well as de novo AMLs. So looking at this here, you can kind of probably start to see where I'm going, which is that you can see that this is sort of a differentiated cancer, is becoming more undifferentiated, and it really sort of begs the question of whether a lot of normal developmental cues that actually go forward take an immature tissue and differentiate it are then reversed in cases of oncogenesis like here. So we looked at this question in context of leukemias and looked at specifically the question of symmetric and asymmetric division that I alluded to earlier in the keynote talk. And asked whether the balance between asymmetric and symmetric division, where asymmetric division would mostly drive kind of a differentiated tissue and more cell fate commitment, and balances out with normal symmetric renewal, where you get more immature cells, whether it's really in any way dysregulated in context of oncogenesis and may be a novel target for therapy. So we had found in previous work that if you looked at chronic and acute leukemias in this context, we found normal balances of asymmetric division and symmetric renewal, which resemble the normal tissue. And so we had sort of hypothesized that maybe chronic leukemias were chronic because while they were growing fast and they're proliferating and clearly survival was increased, in the end, these oncogenes couldn't alter the balance between symmetric and asymmetric division, and therefore the total differentiation content resembled the normal tissue and the cancer was more differentiated. However, other oncogenes like MUV98-HOXA9 in our hands were able to shift divisions away towards symmetric renewal, and we had sort of thought that that may be a point of control, is how you get a more immature disease. And we thought this was important because then if what you really want to do is sort of somehow come in, and if you understood how the oncogene was able to shift this axis, what you really want to do is straighten this, or you know, ideally even make it go this way, impose asymmetry, impose a greater deal of a greater extent of differentiation, and perhaps impair the path of the cancer. So around the time that we had done this work, what we'd known was the cell fate determinant NUM was being inherited asymmetrically in hematopoietic stem cells and was preferentially going into differentiated daughters. But we really didn't know anything about the cancer side of things. So we looked at chronic and acute leukemias and found that actually NUM was high in chronic leukemia And it was lower in acute leukemia, suggesting that there were clear reversal of classic differentiation cues as the cancer progressed. So obviously the question was this of any functional consequence? We took models of acute leukemia, which is really aggressive. So we did a double hit of BCR-ABL and NUM98. And if you put in, just to give you a sense of how aggressive it is, 100 cells today into a mouse, in about 2 weeks, the mouse is dead. So we're taking a very sort of one extreme end of aggressive cancer. And this is obviously a survival curve where you can see the control mice coming down with disease. And ectopic expression of NUM impairs the progress so much so that these cancers have a lower load of cancer stem cells, so that if you transplant them, now 80% of the mice are now alive. And considering the aggressiveness of the disease, it's really impressive that one differentiation cue can sort of undo its aggressive path. And if you look at cellularly, the cells within the cancer, about 30% are usually lineage negative and contain cells that propagate it, whereas in the presence of NUM, this is really heavily depleted. So obviously, we could ectopically upregulate NUM and resolve the tumor progression. So the question was how oncogenes are able to keep NUM low in context of taking a cancer from being chronic to becoming acute. And we looked at a gene called Musashi, who was named after this very famous Japanese samurai, who developed a way of fighting with two swords. And the mutant has this self-fate defect that leads to two bristles instead of one. And this gene has been actually shown to repress NUM. So we looked at the consequences of this gene in context of leukemia formation and found, in fact, that in the absence of Musashi, not only are stem cells reduced, but the absence of Musashi also leads to reduced incidence of this aggressive cancer. And if you look at shRNA, you see in the primary cancers, you also get 50% survival. And if you then take whatever cancers do come down and transplant it in secondary disease, most of the mice are now alive. So we looked to see what this really said about human cancer and human cancer progression. And this is a collaboration with Jerry Radich in Seattle. And what they found, they had looked at 120 patient samples. It was just really remarkable to me because chronic phase, everyone's really low for Musashi. And as you become aggressive in human patients, every patient is heavily upregulated Musashi. This is actually true in reverse for NUM, where majority of the patients have now very low levels of NUM, which is very similar actually to the mouse model. Interestingly, what we found is that in chronic phase, although all the patients were actually really low, they were breaking up into sort of two populations, with one set having lower levels of Musashi than the second. What Vivian and Jerry did was they ran a risk analysis and found that, in fact, patients who had already started to upregulate Musashi in chronic phase were 4.5 to 6 times more likely to relapse or die, suggesting that Musashi could potentially be a prognostic for people who've been diagnosed in chronic phase but who may go on to develop more aggressive disease. For this piece of the work, what we've shown is that basically when you have a first hit of a chronic disease-related oncogene such as BCR-ABL, it does increase proliferation survival, but is unable to skew the balance between asymmetric and symmetric division, allowing a cancer to grow, but allowing it to grow as a more differentiated disorder, where we find Musashi levels are low and NUM levels are high. The second hit, however, which includes a multiple hits, like NUM98 or P53 mutations, do lead to a block in differentiation, which is known. And what I think what we're bringing to this is the idea that these pathways upregulate Musashi and downregulate NUM, and that leads to a shift in the balance of asymmetric division and pushes it more towards symmetric renewal divisions, which then leads to the block in differentiation and then leads to a much more aggressive cancer. But I think what's more important from the work we've done is that it says that there's certainly a window of therapeutic intervention here, so you can take a disease that looks very much blocked in differentiation and very aggressive, but if you know the right differentiation cues, it appears to remain sensitive to becoming differentiated, so you can take this last crisis CML, increase differentiation by reducing Musashi or increasing Noom, and essentially shift the balance back towards having more asymmetric division. And that imposes a more differentiated fate and can block leukemic growth. So this, just to put it back in context of other work that we've done and others have done, that multiple development pathways appear to be involved in hematologic malignancies. And this is just work from the last few years, so it's really interesting that some of this has actually already gone into trials, and Katrina is obviously leading the work on Hedgehog and multiple other ones. But I think what's sort of interesting is all of them appear to be able to target the cells that are propagating the cancer, and that may be a consequence of them being developmental pathways and important in embryogenesis and differentiation. And so they may end up, I mean, hopefully be targets sort of worthy of long-term work. So I'm actually going to talk a little bit about imaging, but I did want to say that although we've mostly focused on leukemia and Musashi, Musashi is actually heavily upregulated in other solid cancers like glioblastoma, and breast cancer, and not been really pursued functionally. And I think, ironically, Musashi, who never lost a battle, like he fought 70 of them, in the end died of cancer. So I think it's sort of kind of intriguing to consider the possibility that he died of his own gene. But you know, I have to go exhume his body to figure that out. So I want to just take a few minutes to talk about some imaging work that we've done. Can we get the lights down? And this is sort of a major part of our lab, looking in vivo, essentially. And this shows you sort of a view into the living bone marrow of a mouse. This is a red mouse that's been transplanted with a GFP-positive progenitor that's going to show up in a second. But it just gives you a sense that you can really see individual cells really clearly. We can image some of you in 10 and 12 hours at a stretch. Here's a GFP-positive cell that shows up. And just to give you a sense that the spatial and temporal resolution is so high that you can not only see individual cells, but you can also really now start to think about the temporal nature of associations, because this cell, for example, really hangs out for a straight 8 hours as long as we image. And it gives you a sense that this cell really is making connections, whereas all of these are obviously going by. So there's a real ability to now take apart temporal interactions and with specific niches and micro niches. So this obviously has led us to try to figure out how do we go and figure out these. I'm just going to stop this here. This is actually a blue mouse. We call this the blue Christmas, because we used to call it red and green Christmas, and then the blue was blue Christmas. But this is a blue mouse that's been crossed into a notch reporter mouse that actually the reporter lights up osteoblasts, and the red is a total bone marrow transplant. So you'll see cells that move really fast. They're actually more mature, and cells are moved more slowly, and they're more immature. But the idea here was to start to take apart the niches and say, okay, where are they hanging out? I mean, who are they associating with? And so this, for example, is really associating with this cell, whereas others are just kind of moving by, for example. And that really gives you a lot of power, I think, to come in and ask what is really going on in the body. You know, what does regeneration really mean, and how does cancer progression really occur? So using this, we have actually started to compare regeneration of different types, some which repair quickly, like chemotherapy at particular doses, and others like radiation, which are very devastating and hard to recover without a transplant. So what I'm going to show you quickly here this is a red mouse transplanted with green progenitor cells after chemo. And what you can see is, which was really startling to us, because we didn't really know where all this was going, except as we were watching this, we see all these cells sort of come in, and they're essentially of inflammatory background. So they're all myeloid cells that sort of all come in after the injury. And it was the first time I thought, you know, we never really think about this, but really bone marrow injury is probably mostly like wound repair. And these are all cells that are normally active in wound repair, and we're sort of watching it happen in real time. And if you compare this to sort of lethal irradiation, actually, and that movie is running, what is remarkable is sort of the silence that you see with radiation. There's very few cells that have taken off. They were transplanted with the same number of green cells. And just nothing is moving. I mean, it's remarkable that, you know, anyone ever actually recovers. So it really gives you a sense of this. But really, what the point I wanted to make is what this led us to is the sort of a discovery of a possible way the body repairs, and looking at the possibility that myeloid cells actually may be involved, and inflammatory cells may be involved in bone marrow repair and regeneration, and could that accelerate repair in a situation where things weren't going so well. So here we're looking at radiation with a transplant of GFP-positive lineage-negative cells. This is a line scan analysis of a live image. And you can see the green peaks are low. With radiation and myeloid co-transplantation, you can see a much, much greater amount of recovery here and much higher levels of transplanted cells. So the regeneration really takes off. This is after 4 days. You know, does this really mean anything about long-term repair? So here we've mimicked a potential clinical situation where this is a survival curve of mice that are lethally irradiated and receiving a suboptimal transplant. This could happen, you know, in a patient situation where there's not enough stem cells, for example. So half the mice are here not recovering and not living. But then if you introduce myeloid cells, there's a really a remarkable increase in the survival here, and now all of the mice really recover. So, but I think it's interesting because, like, I really didn't think of this at all until we start to image, and it just gives you a sense of the power of live imaging to really try to understand the body kind of in real time. So I'm kind of done. This is just to say that the imaging can be actually used to look at solid tissues as well. This is the gut. This is looking at villi, and I think, you know, people obviously have still images, people have, you know, schematics and cartoons, but to see sort of the real thing is really remarkable. You know, this is sort of what, you know, inside of the body looks like. So that's to say that in terms of collaboration, that we'd be really happy to work with people who look at other tissues and try to move some of this forward more broadly. These are just all the people who've done the work. I use this slide in other places to say that I'm moving to San Diego, so I'm moving here. just so you know, I'm moving here. All the imaging, the in vitro imaging that I didn't show led to a lot of understanding of asymmetric division in cancer. That was then picked up by Young and Hiro to look at those mechanisms in cancer. And other work that's been done by Kendra Ryan. A number of people are moving here. Some of them are here. And then the other work that I talked about was all the imaging that was done by Jeff Harris. And we've just had incredible collaborators, including some of you here. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? You mentioned some clinical work was being done on the Miyashi Numin inhibitors.
The hedgehog attack?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's in charge of the trial, so you answer that. You answer that.
So we get the warning shot across the bow, we start studying things in human cells to see if the same things are true in humans, hematopoietic stem cells, and the human stem cells that we've identified, and to what degree can we inhibit those pathways and get away with it, basically. And we never really know that until we get into a clinical trial. So we can model all we like, but when you get into people, it can be quite different. And of course, it's because we have microenvironmental factors that are different, and also with the disease state, that changes how hematopoietic stem cells and other stem cells and other diseases behave. So I'm the principal investigator of the clinical trial here at UC San Diego. It's open at the French Hutch in Seattle and also in Bologna, and more recently opened at MD Anderson Cancer Center. We are actively accruing patients that have refractory hematologic malignancies. Primarily myeloid, again, because Tanishta's work and our work showing that it really seems to be more involved in myeloid malignancies, although we've started to think more about lymphoid malignancies. So we're really happy to move ahead so quickly. That collaboration started just probably about 2 years ago, and the clinical trial started in March. So that's what I mean about accelerating the timelines. The other thing I wanted to mention is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine has really helped to allow all of us to do work on human stem cells, but also obviously on model systems that really have tremendous implications for the clinic. And I think obviously we've been able to move forward therapeutically, but we also have to think about companion diagnostics and developing better biomarker profiles so we can predict who's likely to respond so that I don't have to go over to the hospital after this session to see my patient on a clinical trial. So, you know, that's just a little hope that we can do that together. We are, but we're not using it for selection. We're just using it to say, okay, we know a priori where they're at, and then we'll see how they'll respond. And I'll go into that a little bit, but you know, we'll talk about that when I introduce the next person. So, yes,
Larry. So Tanisha, I'm curious about what it is in the myeloid lineage. Do you think it's the macrophages cleaning up the mess, or is there something more subtle going on?
They're actually all, oh, I see. So first of all, they're GR1 positive, so they seem to be granulocytes. Which they're both involved in a normal wound repair. They both come in, like macrophages come in, granulocytes come in. We don't exactly know what they're doing. I mean, we have these profiles of what changes in the microenvironment post-delivery in a situation where regeneration is accelerated. And one thing we do know, actually, is that we used, in that case, an MMP knockout mouse, and we did not get recovery. So we do know that there's some remodeling involved there. And we see, in fact, in the absence of MMP9, there's this increased fibrosis that sort of sets in. I think that says that, I mean, I just think it's interesting that it says many, many parallel wound repair pathways seem to be kind of active, including the requirement for MMP9. But that's as far as I know in terms of mechanism. I can tell you what factors have changed. I don't actually know which of them are functionally causing this yet.
Interesting. Okay.
Thanks. So let me also mention, however, that you mentioned CIRM, both the two grants for early translational research studies. Earlier this year, you received one, and Alison received one of the others. So that's nice. You should both thank Alan.
Alan, yay, Alan!
All right.